I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The blockades have been dragged off the streets of La Paz in Bolivia, but protesters who forced the resignation of the president aren't finished yet. They are still insisting that Bolivia change its economic ways, that it market its natural gas in a way that better benefits the poor people in the country. And they have a case. Despite those vast gas reserves, Bolivians remain the poorest people in all of South America. And it's this division between rich and poor that is being felt in political terms all across the Americas. In countries like Venezuela and Brazil, it's given strong support to left-wing governments. There are also many people suspicious about the nature of democracy in places like Peru and Ecuador and across Central America. So what's happening? Despite the very recent blossoming of democracy across the Americas, are the blooms already starting to wilt? President Bush has talked of a Western Hemisphere that lives in liberty, trades in freedom, and grows in prosperity. But are people in Central and South America listening? Why do you think people there seem to view democracy as a way for rich people to get richer and for foreign corporations to succeed? Are they right? Or are people in these countries just expecting too much? Is it more patience that's required, or a new model of democracy? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are starting today with Bill Ferries. He's a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He has been covering the unrest in Bolivia, and he's on the line from the capital city, La Paz. Bill, it's nice of you to join us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Things back to business now after this period of blockades and strikes?
Things have largely calmed down, not only in La Paz, the capital, but throughout the country since last Thursday night. The Congress handed power over to the head of the Supreme Court, Eduardo Rodriguez, who last night got about the business of naming a new cabinet. And people seem to be giving him some time to get things going.
Now, still word from some of the opposition leaders and the indigenous people that they may not give him that much time to try and rearrange the affairs of the country. Are they serious?
Well, it's hard to know. Initially, some of the more radical groups said that they would give the president just 72 hours to begin addressing their agenda of nationalization and the drafting of a new constitution. They seem to have stepped back from that, and most groups seem to be willing to give the president at least a couple weeks to see where his government will be headed.
And just how much support is there for opposition politicians, opposition political groups, like the movement toward socialism, that might in fact take Bolivia to a point where natural gas reserves and other resources would be nationalized? Is that a genuine possibility, Bill?
Well, there's two things in your question there. One is that the traditional political parties here are really discredited. I think almost across the political spectrum here, you see a lot of dissatisfaction with the parties that have been in control of Bolivian politics for the last 20 years. And that's one of the reasons that you see so much support, I think, for groups like the Movement Towards Socialism mm-hmm. and its leader, Evo Morales. And also, the idea of nationalization is popular here. Even during the worst of the blockades and protests here in La Paz, you would find a lot of people who lived here who were being affected by the protests saying, "We don't agree with the way they're going about their demands, but we agree with their demands." So I think there is definitely a strong trend towards nationalization, and there's a strong anti-globalization feel here.
When you dig in a little bit on that anti-globalization feel, do you also find among people a suspicion or a cynicism about U.S.-style democracy?
There is a lot of suspicion, I think, about the U.S. involvement in Bolivia. But frankly, what you've seen the last 3 or 4 weeks here is people pay a lot of lip service to democracy. I mean, people have been very concerned about whether things here proceed constitutionally. So I think, you know, their interest in democracy is still somewhat strong, but I think they're trying to figure out. Well, what you have here is you have a lot of groups that have traditionally been left out of the politics here, mm-hmm. and they're trying to work their way into this democratic system.
I'm asking you the question.
Part of the conflict.
Sorry, Bill, to interrupt, but the reason I ask you the question is because Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez was saying in one of his long television addresses over the weekend that it is U.S.-style democracy and capitalism that is responsible for the trouble in Bolivia, and I'm just wondering if that point of view has a strong constituency in Bolivia.
I think the economic argument has a stronger constituency here. I think people feel like for about 20 years, Bolivia has been undertaking free market changes here. They've sold off some of their state industries. They've tamed inflation, but they haven't been able to get the benefits of those policies to the majority of the people here. So I think the argument in Bolivia gets a lot more support on the economic side.
Okay, Bill, I want to thank you for being with us. Nice to hear from you.
Sure, thank you.
Bill Ferries is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, joining us there on the line from La Paz in Bolivia. And this hour we're talking in slightly broader terms about Latin America and whether or not we see a drift or a shift to the left, a dissatisfaction from among the poor people in countries right across South America and Central America with the move towards democracy. We'd like to hear from you in this conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined now by Eduardo Gamarra. He is in the NPR studios of WLRN in Miami, Florida. He is professor of political science and director of the Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. Eduardo, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jack Spence is here with me in our Connection studio. He is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts and director of Hemisphere Initiatives. It's a research group focused on peace and democracy in Central America. Jack, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Because of your expertise in Central America, I'll start with you if I can. When you hear Bill describing the situation in Bolivia, are you hearing echoes of this in other nations that you study across the region?
Well, yes and no. I think that Bolivia is an extreme example in the sense that it's quite unusual to have a sitting president or two in a row step down as a result of popular protests. Even in the era of lots of coups in Latin America in past decades, those coups usually came about by way of military interventions. It's also rather different in Central America because they're going through a separate kind of transition, both one toward electoral democracy, but also one from war, from civil war to peace in the last 20 years. But I think Bolivia may be representative in the sense that there's a growing sense of dissatisfaction that the shift toward democratization has not paid off in economic terms. That I think if you look across the region, over the last two decades or 25 years, there's been two parallel transitions. One has been a shift toward electoral democracy away from authoritarian governments, and the other one has been a shift toward neoliberal economic policies, which means the government plays a significantly reduced role in the economy. And the benefits of the one, the electoral democracy, have not been matched by the benefits of the other. That is to say, for most poor people in Latin America, conditions have not gotten better, if they have, only marginally so.
Let me hear the answer to the same question, Eduardo, from you, because you are Bolivian. When you look at what's been going on in your home country, do you see democracy at risk there?
Well, I think democracy is at risk, but I think really more than anything else, it's the definition of democracy that's at risk. And what was just currently said, I think, is important. The benefits of electoral democracy have been many. I think, in fact, even the inclusion of groups like the MAS in Bolivia are a very, very significant achievement of democracy. The incorporation of indigenous sectors in Bolivia is one of the most significant accomplishments of Bolivia. One of the problems with the interpretations of Bolivia that I find right now is this view that democracy has not worked. In fact, in my view at least, democracy has worked. People like Evo Morales would not be so significant if that weren't the case. The problem is, however, that the performance of the economy hasn't gone as well. Bolivians today are living, they're much poorer than their grandparents were in the 1950s. The contrast is not only historical in Bolivia, but if you look at how Bolivians fare, for example, with Brazilians or Chileans, while they have expanded, and they're in the case of Chileans, for example, they're 300% better off than their grandparents, Bolivians are much poorer. So I think you have to put that in the general context of the region to really understand the depth of social exclusion and the depth of the Bolivian situation.
Bill made the point that the traditional political parties in Bolivia are very discredited, and I'm wondering if the lack of faith that people have in those traditional parties is simply being transferred onto other parties, and that for you is a sign of democracy succeeding or not.
See, again, I think here the interpretation, and in politics really perception is everything. The fact is that that incorporation that I addressed a few moments ago is a product of the behavior of the traditional political parties. They diagnose the problem much the way we both have now and put forth some very interesting measures. For example, one of the most interesting was the Popular Participation Law of 1994, which essentially created 326 municipal governments, turning over revenue and basically forcing politics down to the local level. What happened as a result, and this is why I think it's important to look at it, more perhaps as a revolution of rising expectations. These newly incorporated sectors all of a sudden have seen that what they have been missing and are demanding essentially not only the rights of citizenship, but certainly the benefits of economic well-being as well.
All right, Connection listeners, time to hear from you on this. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. When the Organization of American States held a meeting just a week ago, the foreign minister of Brazil said in that session, democracy cannot be imposed. It was a pretty direct slap at some suggestions from the United States that perhaps democracy ought to be monitored in South and Central America, and a sign of the resistance there to some of the U.S. capitalism that comes along with the democracy. But if we look at the picture writ large, is democracy succeeding in Latin America? How do we understand that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. President Bush made the point 30 years ago when you looked across Central and South America, fewer than half the countries there could be rated as democracies. Now, almost all of them are democracies. Is that a sign that the people there are embracing the concept of free market capitalism and democracy at the same time? Maybe not. We're hearing lots of grumbling, certainly from Venezuela and from Brazil and most recently from Bolivia. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us. We're going to take a call from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and David is with us. Hi, David.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I'd like to speak, if I could, anecdotally about the protests in La Paz. I spent the last semester there studying abroad. And what I saw in them was incredible lack of passivity, that these protests were incredibly vibrant and their demands were very genuine. And I don't see how people in other countries could not be inspired.
Give me an example of somebody who you met who had something to say to you that made you stop and go, huh?
Well, I'll speak about the experience itself. The newspapers here in the States really said that La Paz and Bolivia as a whole had come to a standstill, that the country itself was paralyzed. And there's truth to that. On a daily basis, there would be tons of marches in the downtown area of La Paz of various unions and social organizations and student groups. And once the miners came from another department, they brought dynamite to the streets, and it became a really raucous affair. And those marches mixed with the blockades that really crippled every major thoroughfare in the country were incredibly effective. There was a real sense of uncertainty in the city, and I was living with a host family. Each night we'd gather around the television to watch the news, and the great questions would be, would there be food getting through to the city the next day? Would there be gasoline? Would there be fuel?
But aside from the practical effects of the blockade, the host family that you're living with, the people that you talk to, were they saying these people really had a point that deserved to be heard?
I think so. And I think that after decades of right-leaning dictatorships and after administrations of Kennedy School-educated neoliberals, there's some recognition that the indigenous population in Bolivia is of the majority, and they have, throughout the hundreds of year history of Bolivia, not had the leadership that perhaps a majority would deserve, and maybe it's worth a try. I think that there is, and I heard it, an overriding question in Bolivia of can Evo Morales lead? Can you have a socialist government? And I think that there's some resignation among a lot of people there, certainly, that you know, maybe it's worth a try, because the class divide there in Bolivia, to use a gentle term, is incredibly vast.
David, let me turn to Eduardo Gamarra on this one in particular, because the other point of view, Eduardo, and you'll be familiar with this, is that should they go for a socialist form of government, foreign corporations will simply pull out. Those natural gas reserves will never be developed, and Bolivia will go back in time rather than forward. Where's the truth in all this?
Well, it's interesting what the caller is saying. These kinds of photographic and anecdotal remarks, I've been, you know, witnessing for the last 40 years of my life. This is not new. This is something that we've been going through periodically. The problem with these kinds of approaches, and I'm not denying the depth of the problem in Bolivia, the fact of the matter is that whether the leaders are Harvard educated or not, I think is irrelevant. The problem is that you cannot have in any country, and Bolivia in particular, bringing the country to a halt and experiencing huge economic losses. If you think about what happened over the last 3 weeks, El Alto, the city contiguous to La Paz, where most of the mobilization occurred, shut down. As a result, 86 small firms have closed down. And, you know, thousands of jobs have been lost. The cost to Bolivia is huge. And I think that, you know, one of the problems on the part of the international community is that Bolivia, for some reason, has this terrible pattern of either becoming the model for the neoliberals, which we were during the 1990s, or today, unfortunately, the model for the social movement, this philosophy that comes out of primarily younger students of mine, for example, who are idealistic, just like I was 25, 30 years ago. And
But if these people are less well off than their parents or their grandparents, then what is there in this political system that offers them some hope?
Well, first and foremost, what offers them hope is the basic notion that they are citizens and that they are constructing citizenship. The very fact that they can march. I grew up in moments when you couldn't march, where you were repressed or thrown in jail for expressing a point of view. That, I don't think, particularly the younger generation, understands. Most of the younger generation in Bolivia does not remember the moments of military dictatorship. So this democracy, with all of its flaws, is far better than what we used to have in 1980, for example. The problem, of course, is that this is a very, you know, change does not come instantaneously, particularly economic change. This is a generational bet, and you can't have a generational bet when every 2 years you change presidents or every 2 years you think that somehow European NGOs or American NGOs are going to get you out of the bind.
And Connection listeners, that's a good way of putting it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Will people in Latin America be patient enough to see through some of the early days of democracy to look for benefits that might come later on? Or are they going to be disappointed even if they wait? I want to come back to the studio here and Jack Spence, your own perspective on this. As Eduardo was talking, I was thinking, gosh, the younger generation in El Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua grew up in wartime. You can imagine their own expectations for democracy would also be very high. Do they have any reason to be pleased with at least the peace that exists in Central America?
Well, I think Professor Gamarra is correct in a way that can be generalized across Latin America in that the growth of democracy has certainly brought many positive benefits. By and large, elections have been held regularly. Governments have changed hands. By and large, there's been a lack of fraud in the elections. Votes have been counted accurately. There's a huge decrease in human rights abuses. There's a huge decrease, particularly in Central America, of political violence, compared to what it was in the 1980s when we're talking about in a country like El Salvador, 70,000 people killed. That's about the same size population as Massachusetts. So imagine that happening in Massachusetts. In addition to that, the power of militaries has political power and budgetary powers of militaries has been generally reduced all throughout the region. So I think those are all positive signs.
I hear a butt coming, though.
Well, of course, there's always going to be a but, and it goes back to the lack of economic performance. So there was a poll taken last year in a number of different Latin American countries where the poll said, given the choice between increasing your standard of living but losing democracy, which would you choose? And a small majority chose losing democracy in favor of increasing. Now, if you're poor and poverty there is much worse than poverty here, that's not such an irrational choice to make. And, of course, it's sort of a fantasy question for the poll, but I think that's an indication of some level of dissatisfaction. Another level of indication of dissatisfaction that is much more common north of South America is the extent to which people are voting with their feet. They're leaving.
Yeah.
25% of Salvadorans now live in the United States, and they send money home. And in fact, you could say that the money they send home is the central pillar of the Salvadoran economy. That's true for four or five countries in Central America. If they stop sending that money home, those economies will collapse.
Let's go back to our callers, to Belmont, Massachusetts. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi, Dick. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, tell me what you're thinking.
I think the way you phrased the question reflects the hypocrisy of the American stand on democracy. You seem to think that whenever a country democratically chooses a leftist government, that that's anti-democratic. That strikes me as very odd. It seems to me that democracy is intended to give the majority of the people power, and the majority of the people are poor, and if they get political power, it's natural that they're going to try to change the economic system. But whenever they try to do it, the United States seems to try to paint that as being anti-democratic. Democracy does not equal capitalism and free trade.
The interesting thing is that when it is marketed to countries like this, in fact, those things do go in the same package. When you know, Condoleezza Rice talks to people at the OAS, for example, David, she'll, you know, they talk about, you know, market economies, CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. I mean, all of this is supposed to be a part of an American version of democracy, though, no?
Well, but that's the problem with the American version. They're not really interested in democracy. What they're interested in is expanding capitalism and free trade. And if democracy doesn't go along with that, it's just like, you know, when in the 70s, when Chile democratically elected a socialist, well, that wasn't considered democratic.
Yeah, no, David, I take your point, and I wonder if I can turn to Eduardo on this, on just how people in Latin America make those distinctions. Do they get tangled up with bundling together, for example, free market and democracy, or capitalism and democracy, or are the separations clear?
Well, in Latin America, the separation is much clearer. I do agree with the caller. I think, you know, American policy makes that connection, and it's not necessarily a connection that goes hand in hand. And I think you have to look right now at the experience of President Lula, President Tabaré Vázquez, and President Lagos in Chile, three socialists who are running market economies and who understand really two things, that you cannot dismantle the state lock, stock, and barrel, as we attempted to do in Bolivia. Mm-hmm. Secondly, that you need some social programs to at least address the problems of poverty and so on. And third, that you can't do away with the market, and because the international reality today is that, one, you can't deny the importance of foreign direct investment. You can't deny the importance of the private sector. And so the problem, however, in the Latin American context is that while you decouple democracy and capitalism, most activists in particular cannot offer a sensible policy alternative. Let's turn back to Bolivia. If Bolivia nationalizes today, I can guarantee you, and the most interesting thing here is that those companies that are going to be nationalized belong to Spain, mm-hmm. Argentina, and Brazil, three countries headed by leftists who are dreadfully opposed to any kind of nationalization.
Do these countries, and if we generalize here, Jack, do the Latin American countries have the political will and determination to try and draft their own form of democracy that is that mix of socialism and you know, free elections?
Oh, I think they do. Whether that will happen or not, is an open question. I think the drift toward leftist governments in Latin America is one that is could be read as dissatisfaction with the prior incumbent governments and the lack of economic performance. I do think that all across Latin America, referring to Condoleezza Rice and at the OAS, there is a great impatience and rejection of the idea of the United States being the instructor in how to conduct democracy while the Latin Americans are the students. The United States got an enormous black eye in Florida all across Latin America in 2000. And I think that many Latin Americans have pretty severe criticisms of the way electoral democracy operates in the United States. They would say, for example, that we basically have a non-competitive electoral system with regard to the House of Representatives. If you're an incumbent, you have a 99% chance of getting reelected. They disagree with the Senate, where Vermont has two senators and 600,000 people, and California has two senators and 58 million people.
And they're that closely connected to the American political system that they're saying that's, you know, you ought not be to be lecturing us on how to run our own
Absolutely.
Government?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They've had enough of their elections monitored by international groups, and I've been a monitor, where they are quite willing to say, and we'd like to come to Chicago for the next election so we can monitor it.
Eduardo, did you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I think he's absolutely correct. And living in Florida, of course, makes it even worse. The observation here was made very keenly to me on a number of occasions. Electoral democracy is probably one of the things that we've done very well throughout the region. The Brazilian technology, Mexican electoral technology, is something that we could use here in Florida and in the United States more generally. The problem, however, of course, is that, you know, there's a real, real gap between democracy and Democrats. And this is what the point I was trying to make earlier. A democracy is something you construct over a long period of time. But we live in societies that are short-term, that want benefits immediately. It's very difficult. If you look, for example, at the scales of tolerance, the commitment to democratic values, the kinds of data that's now available, what you find is a real gap. For example, in Bolivia, the more education Bolivians achieve, the greater their level of intolerance, something that is
What do you mean by intolerance? Political intolerance?
Political intolerance, intolerance, racial intolerance, and so on. Something that, you know, was and by the way, this is the data that Mitchell Seligson from Vanderbilt University has been generating, which is striking because normally what you find in countries like the United States, although one might argue that that's not happening anymore, but it's this logic that the greater the degree of education, the more tolerant people become, the more accepting of others, of other political opinions. But in Bolivia and in many countries of Latin America, what you have is this very interesting relationship between educational systems and greater degrees of intolerance.
Jack, quickly from you, this idea that democracy, when it's sold, is supposed to bring a form of equality. People there quite rightly, I think, look at equality and measure that in economic terms. So is there ever going to be a wholesale embrace of democracy if it doesn't answer some of the economic issues that are so important to people?
Well, I don't think there will be. I would say it's more complicated than simply saying equality if you're talking about things like equality of income. What is lacking in many countries in Latin America is progress, for example, in education, or significant progress in education.
Healthcare as well, I suppose.
And healthcare is another one. And those, there's a broad consensus across the political spectrum that things need to get better. But there are rarely policies or the money to back up the policies to create significant improvements in those two key areas. So there are whole social programs that are lacking, and throughout the region the government spending on programs like that is hamstrung because of international complications that have come about through renegotiating international debt problems, et cetera. So many of those countries have very low tax coefficients. They collect a small amount of taxes, and they're strained to spend those taxes on programs like that. The chief exception would be Costa Rica.
Although Bolivia was one of those countries which had a certain amount of its debt removed when the G7 ministers met last week to get rid of debt. Does that kind of thing make a difference? How do people in Latin America measure democracy, and what would it take for those people to continue to embrace the institutions of democracy, free election? Does there need to be some kind of economic well-being that simply goes along with that. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Do the past 3 weeks of protests against elected politicians in Bolivia lead us to question if democracy itself is beginning to wilt in Latin America? Certainly people like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela would have us believe that it is a determined swing away from U.S.-style democracy that goes along with capitalism. And we do see some evidence of other nations embracing parties that are to the left. David, our caller, points out quite rightly, though, that simply to vote for a left-leaning party is not anti-democratic. What's happening in Central and South and Latin America? Are people there devising their own form of democracy? 1-800-423-TALK to join us. Jack Spence is here with me in the studio. He is professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts and director of Hemisphere Initiatives. And Eduardo Gamarra is with us from Miami, Florida. He is professor of political science and director of the Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. We'd like to hear from you as well. To Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Nancy's on the line. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, I was wondering if the speakers could address the issue of history. And specifically, I was wondering what role history plays in making democracy difficult to function in Latin America.
How far do you want to go back, Nancy? Are we talking about the Spanish here, or are we talking about America's involvement? I'm sorry?
Back to that they've had about 500 years of history of corruption from upper classes who are generally the people who stay in office now. And so I was wondering if that could be addressed, that it's difficult after having so much history that it's difficult to switch into a purely democratic system.
Jack, I'm going to have you start on that. I'm wondering if there is sort of inbred in the lower and middle class this kind of suspicion against the elites that Nancy's talking about, and if that's in history as well.
Well, there is a long history of authoritarianism in Latin America that pervaded both the political systems and the economic system. So I think a simple way of thinking about it would be that the historical arrangements in Latin America were based on a plantation system of economy with either forced or semi-forced systems of labor ranging from slavery to what's called debt peonage, where peasants were systematically put in debt and then forced to work on these plantations. The heritage of that comes up to very recent times. You can still find examples of that in Guatemala, for example, and that led quite mechanically almost to the plantocracy, or the heads of these plantations in Central America would be the coffee elite, to, in coordination with the military, running the government. That history goes up pretty close to the last, to say, 20 years ago, and it's slowly evolving away from it. Now, in response to the caller's question, you can still find in a number of countries the people who were on top of the heap under the old system remain on top of the heap under the new system. In El Salvador, the folks who control the banks, which are among the most strongest banks in Central America, are pretty much the same families that controlled coffee.
So the suspicion is reasonably based.
Now, I think it's much more complicated when you get to the larger countries in Latin America, where the economies are more diverse and it's hard to trace. You can't really say in Brazil, for example, that the old coffee elite still runs things. It's a much more diverse industrialized economy.
Let me interrupt you, though, because Eduardo, when we talk about Bolivia in this context and the people there say, we want the revenue from our natural gas, they have a very specific piece of history that they're recalling, no?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Bolivia, essentially, what is Bolivia today? The one mountain in the city of Potosí produced all of the silver. About 90% of the silver that's currently in circulation came from that one mountain. Hugely wealthy. That was replaced really after the 1880s by a tin mining economy controlled by three tin barons, Bolivians, not Americans, although they were incorporated in the United States. But if you look at Bolivia, from the fabulous wealth of silver followed by this long process of tin exploitation, and now the hydrocarbon cycle, much of the left in Bolivia believes, you know, we've had really 500-600 years of this kind of exploitation, and look at where we are now. we're not going to let this happen now with natural gas. Bolivia, after Venezuela, has the highest, the greatest reserves in natural gas, about 48 TCFs. 48 trillion TCFs,
cubic feet.
Yeah. So what you have then is this I think a natural expectation that this time around Bolivia is going to do it a little differently. The problem, of course, is that you cannot exploit these natural resources without heavy doses of investment, and Bolivia does not have the access to capital to basically get all of those the tonnage of minerals that are still left, or the gallons of hydrocarbons that Bolivia could produce.
To take another example of would be copper in Chile, which two American corporations controlled for most of the 20th century on up to 1973. And the saying in Chile was, they took the copper and left the holes. So there is suspicion, I think, of multinational investments, particularly when it regards natural resources.
1-800-423-8255 to Southern Pines, South Carolina. John's with us. Hello, John.
Yes, how are you?
Fine, thanks. What do you think?
Well, we found, I do a lot of business in Latin America, but we do almost all of our business through Mexico. We're an American corporation. We have a number of companies, but we set up a manufacturing and distribution through Mexico because we find that that's a much more amenable way of getting our products into Latin America than it is to go in as an American. So we're shipping material essentially manufactured in Mexico, although the technology is rooted in the U.S.
And where do you trace this anti-American sentiment that causes you to do business that way? Does it go back to the U.S. involvement in recent civil wars there, or what are you looking at?
I think it's less. It's more of an inconsistency in policy from one administration to another. There's never been any consistency in the policy that the U.S. has towards Latin America. On one hand, they're involved and interested, but it seems to be an economic involvement. And then the next administration will come in with a democratic slant and try and convince the Latin Americans that they're not interested in interference in terms of their politics or in terms of their economics, and they're just this inconsistency has left them, the Latin Americans, somewhat confused about what the real ambitions of the United States are.
So a pallet of manufactured goods comes in with "Made in Mexico" on them, and you're saying that people there are more willing to involve themselves with that, more willing to market, more willing to buy it than if it were to have, say, "Made in USA"?
Yes, and I think that that is changing. And has changed quite a bit. American goods used to have a much higher profile than they do now. What is happening is we're seeing a change in that. This country is no longer considered, I think, the ultimate in terms of a lot of type commodities. We're in the agricultural business, so our products essentially are worldwide commodities now, in a sense, and therefore the country of origin is not nearly as important as it used to be. There used to be an automatic thought in the mind of the consumer that if it was American, or it was superior, and we're not seeing that anymore.
I'm wondering, Eduardo, does this mark any? Can we mark this as a rise in self-sufficiency in Latin America? Just the fact that they have the luxury to make those kinds of choices.
Well, for really the better part of the 20th century, many in Latin America thought that, and really through import substitution strategies, that we could somehow forget about particularly American products and create our own. Import substitution, of course, led to an inflated size of the state and not a very efficient way of producing and so on. But that era, in fact, in some measure, brought in what is currently happening in Latin America, and that is that you have some very efficient production going on in Brazil. You have some a very efficient process in Chile and so on. But what's really underlying what the gentleman said, and I think it's really important, it's not that there's inconsistency in U.S. policy. In fact, I think U.S. policy has been fairly consistent. What's inconsistent is the application of it. One administration gives precedence to one dimension of it and, in fact, contradicts what a previous administration might have said. That has led, and particularly now, for example, the overwhelming emphasis on terrorism and the overwhelming emphasis on the security side. And I think a bungled opportunity for the United States. Latin America is one of the most anti-American regions of the world. And curiously, public opinion polls tell you that the Mexicans are among the most anti-American, and they're the ones with the greatest amount of contact with the United States.
Is it, Jack, that anti-American attitude that is leading so many of the Central American countries to raise an eyebrow at CAFTA? I know the presidents and prime ministers have signed on, but there are a lot of people in Central America who aren't that interested in this latest free trade agreement.
Well, I think that there's a fairly widespread perception in Central America and in Latin America that the U.S. there are aspects of U.S. policies which are inconsistent to the point of being hypocritical.
For instance,
the United States is pushing free trade, and that has had and will have in Central America negative impacts on the poorest of the poor, the peasants who are growing subsistence crops of corn, because heavily subsidized U.S. corn production will come in at a cheaper rate than they can produce the corn. At the same time, the Brazilians produce orange juice at a much cheaper rate than do the heavily subsidized orange juice producers in Florida. Well, on that one, the United States isn't so much for free trade. So there's that level of inconsistency, which to a Latin American perspective is you've got us coming and going. You win and we lose, either way you do it.
Did you want to jump in there, Eduardo?
Yeah, I just wanted to add one additional dimension, which obviously is very controversial. But, you know, we've been, since Jimmy Carter's administration, been pushing the human rights line. One of the biggest, I think, the most serious errors that the U.S. has committed from the perspective of Latin Americans is what has happened in the Iraqi prisons and in Guantanamo. That's what they're reading. They're saying, you're telling us to respect human rights when you, in fact, are not. And I think, you know, that does more damage in a very short period of time than decades of trying to construct goodwill.
I want to take this just a little bit further, because aside from creating ill will between the United States and countries in Latin America, does it also go to the extent of getting people in Latin America thinking that they don't want a political system similar to the one that's in the United States?
Well, let's take a look at Chavez, for example, at President Chavez in Venezuela. He basically headed a movement that benefited from 30 years of a corrupt, kleptocratic, democratic system run by two political parties. He promised in some measure that he would be less corrupt, and also that, you know, that the benefits of democracy would translate into economic benefits for the poor. The problem is that these notions of direct democracy that Andean Latin Americans in particular seem to be espousing, whether it's the MAS in Bolivia or other movements, including the Bolivarianismo of Venezuela, are in many ways throwbacks to old-fashioned Latin American corporatism, where you have a single hegemonic party, where you have exclusion of anyone who basically disagrees with you, and so on. And that's what worries me, and that takes me back to this idea of intolerance, that those people who are claiming that they have not had a fair share of participation in the political system, in fact, are the ones who are most intolerant in terms of the kind of political system that they're trying to, that they're allegedly trying to construct.
Let me take one more call. This one from Kingston, Rhode Island, and Imar's joining us on the line. Imar, you're calling us with some firsthand experience here.
Yes, I am. My father is Aymara from Lake Titicaca in Peru, and I have grown up in both places, in Rhode Island and in Peru. Which is right on the border of Bolivia, so I'm always watching with great interest what goes on in La Paz there.
Are we missing something here, Aymar, that you wanted to put on the table?
Yeah, I just wanted to express the complete lack of regard to the strong indigenous context of this rebellion in Bolivia, and that it is a democracy. I agree with the caller earlier who mentioned that it was there was a difference between democracy and capitalist democracy, and I do think that those people have been looking and someday will succeed in attaining a more of a communal sort of democracy that doesn't base on, you know, economic and social pressure from the outside. And it is a process which has been going on for thousands of years and will continue to transform.
Well, one quick one for you, though. Can that degree of indigenous power be expressed in a democratic political system?
Oh, of course it can, but it has to be of its own makeup and its own creation. And for example, I would tell people to look at the water war of Cochabamba, which occurred in 2000, which started all the unrest, where they threw out Bechtel, a company that was privatizing their water, skyrocketed the water prices, and they had and have attained in Cochabamba a communal participatory democracy on many levels of the political apparatus there.
Jack?
There are echoes of the indigenous theme, of course, in Guatemala, where either a very large minority or a small majority of the population is indigenous. They're Mayan, although it's different in the sense that the Mayans are divided into 22 different language groups. They have, in Guatemala, the political electoral system, even now, is rather exclusive. It is the rates of voting among Mayans are much, much lower than among non-Mayans. And I think it's largely because it's much more difficult to register if you live in a rural area and if you're Mayan, given language difficulties and the fact that you have to travel 20 or 30 miles to go and register to vote.
Mm-hmm. Is that changing, though?
It's changing, but it's not changing very fast. And we're talking about a group that, if it voted as a block, would have 40 to 50% of the votes in the country. There are very few, though an increasing number of Mayan mayors, and there are very few people in the national legislature that are of Mayan background. On the other hand, you can find at the local level traditional, almost parallel governments of Mayan governments existing
right.
in one municipality after another that have existed, sometimes repressed into sort of secret forms, but have existed in parallel form to the official municipal government.
Quick last question to you, Eduardo. We have talked about this impatience, and you've talked about mm-hmm. how people need to wait a little bit. If we look a generation or two ahead, are we going to see indigenous people properly represented politically? Are we going to see some of what these imbalances we're talking about addressed?
I would hope so, and I think, in fact, if you look at even Bolivia today is really a shade of what it was in 1952 when the first revolution occurred that mobilized and incorporated the indigenous for the very first time. So, yes, I would hope that at least in those terms it would. The problem, again, it goes back to the economic performance of democracy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, just to the caller, the Cochabamba water wars were certainly important. They certainly didn't bring communal democracy to Cochabamba. And the Cochabambinos, as they're called, today have no water. And more importantly, there is an extreme degree of corruption in the state institution that was created to replace that water, that privatized water system that they threw out.
Eduardo, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Eduardo Gomara, professor of political science and director of Latin American and Caribbean Center at Florida International University. Jack Spence, thank you so much for being here as well.
Thank you.
Jack is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.